Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio in association with Stony Brook Southampton Graduate Arts. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions change their careers, what relationships influence their work.
Thank you.
This week, we're doing something different. A couple of months back, I had the great honor of talking with Dustin Hoffman as part of the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival in Hollywood. At the festival, we screen some of the greatest films of all time, and much of Dustin Hoffman's work fits that description. We selected Lenny, the 1974 film in which Hoffman portrays the groundbreaking but troubled comedian and social critic Lenny Bruce, who had died 8 years prior of a drug overdose while battling ongoing obscenity charges.
We decided to show this movie about Lenny Bruce at 11:30 in the morning. We're going to show Tootsie at midnight. We thought we'd mix it up a bit here at the TCM Festival.
Lenny, shot in black and white by director Bob Fosse, was nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director for Fosse, Best Actress for Valerie Perrine, and Best Actor for Dustin Hoffman.
We're all the same schmuck. And it just cracks me up that we try so desperately to be unique when we're all the same cat. Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, me, you. Every cat has got that one chick who really busted up his ass.
I'm kind of speechless whenever I see this film. I've seen it a lot, which that doesn't come in handy when you have to interview somebody after the film to be rendered speechless. But I don't want to labor this too much. But this is a movie actor who is unlike any other of the last 75 years. You know, there's a lot of great film stars, and there's a lot of great actors working, especially through the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and on beyond that. But few of them took the chances to become a different person so many times in films and transform themselves physically, emotionally, psychologically, their voice, to inhabit a character. I don't think there's another actor alive in the film business in the last several years who transformed themselves again and again, and then would play something very close to themselves, their own speech, their own behavior, perhaps their voice. In All the President's Men, and in Kramer versus Kramer. please. But I just want to say that this is a person I've admired on the deepest level for a long, long time. And it's my great pleasure to ask you to join me in welcoming Dustin Hoffman.
Too kind. Thank you.
When you make films like this, you made so many great films and worked with so many great directors. Was Fosse someone, and was that a goal for you, too, to work with Fosse?
No.
How was it to work with Fosse?
Tough.
Tough.
Bob was originally a choreographer. And choreographers don't have dancers coming up to them saying, "What's my motivation?" Dancers do what they're told.
Right.
You know, he tried to be... in a sense, to collaborate, but it was tough for him, and it was tough for me. We had a tough time.
Did he like to do a lot of takes?
Yes, both of us did. The script, I thought, was problematic, so I wasn't that anxious to do it. We went into rehearsal with the principal actors, with the wonderful Valerie Perrine. Extraordinary performance. And with Valerie, myself, and Jane Minor, and I think Stanley Beck, we're in New York in a room, and it's going rough, the rehearsal. And after 5 days, we started on Monday, after 5 days, we're rehearsing routines, we're rehearsing scenes. And on Friday, Bob Fosse says, we don't have a movie. We don't have a script. See you on Monday. We rehearsed 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And we thought it was going to be shelved. Went home and came back Monday, and he says, I solved it. And he interspersed it. He says, I'm going to intersperse it with interviews because these scenes, there's no connective tissue to them. They don't connect. So Stanley Beck, who was wonderful in it, my manager, Valerie Pete, thank you. Stanley and I were close friends since we were beginning actors. And Valerie Perrine and Jan Miner are going, I think that's all it is, isn't it? Those three are going to be interviewed throughout the movie, and I'll have an easier time of shooting it. By the way, that's Bob Fosse asking the questions.
Now, when you make a film like this, or any of the films you've made, I should say, do you have any kind of unique relationship or a specific relationship with the cinematographer, Surtees? This film was nominated for 6 Academy Awards, and in every one of the major categories you would imagine, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Screenplay, and Cinematography for Surtees, who made his reputation shooting a lot of Clint Eastwood's films for many, many years.
Bob Surtees was one of the great cinematographers, Robert Surtees. He was the cinematographer of The Graduate. Right. Bruce is his son.
Is his son, right.
Yes.
Right.
No, we were good friends.
So you work with the father and son tandem.
Yes.
So when you shoot a film, do you have a specific relationship with cinematographers when you make a film or no?
No, I don't. I don't want to know where the camera is in terms of... I do ask about lenses sometimes if I want my hands to do something, and I say, where are you cutting? Where's your bottom frame? Because if it's here, also I'd have to have my hands up here to have it in the shot. Other than that, I don't really want to know. It's interesting that you say that, Alec, because one of the things I objected to with Bob is that he posed me. And when you see it, it's gorgeous. So he was right, I was wrong. But, you know, I'd be up there, and I worked so hard on these routines. I had never seen Lenny Bruce. Bob had never seen Lenny Bruce. Mike Nichols, who I talked to before I did it, because he'd done The Graduate, he and Elaine May were acting upstairs on Sunset Boulevard. Was it called the Duplex or something?
I don't know.
Nightclub. And Lenny Bruce was downstairs. And in between their acts, they would come downstairs and watch Bruce, because no comedian, they said, would do a whole show improvising. You know, sometimes you do 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and the rest is your stuff. But Lenny would come out and not know what he was going to say. I think the only two comedians I know since Lenny that do that, one was Rob. One was Robin Williams, and the other one was a wonderful Billy Connolly. And neither of them, many times, would just go. And that takes a lot. What was the question?
We were talking about cinematographers and.
Oh,
you posing,
so yeah, so he would pose me, and I worked hard. I got the 33 RPMs that Lenny had made. That's what we called them then. We didn't call them vinyls. And I'd lay down on the floor, and I would play. I had about three months, and I did every, I wrote down longhand every single line he said in all the records. And he, even the ones he did over, he would always deviate, and I would write them down, and then I would go to Bob Fosse, and I'd say, geez, I like what he did here because he used these sentences or he used that. And I was promised, and I think that's what I got so upset about, that I would be able to shoot it. We were going to shoot it, and I think that's what Bob wanted. We were going to shoot it in different clubs in Florida and with live audiences, and that's what I wanted. I want to be able to really feel like I'm doing it with a real audience, and you'll have, whatever, 3-4 cameras at once. He agreed, and that's what we were supposed to do, and then it's probably money wouldn't allow it. So it was quite laborious sometimes to do these routines over and over again, and he would tilt the camera. He'd be like where you are, and I'd be on the stage. He'd say, okay, now look a little bit this way, now look up, now look down. Okay, now do the routine from here to here. And, you know, it kind of broke my heart because I was trying to be the guy. You know, Fosse was a great, great artist. And it's funny because I just saw a film recently with that Alfred Hitchcock directed with Cary Grant. And Cary Grant said he'd never work with Hitchcock again after the first picture because they didn't get along, because Hitchcock didn't like to collaborate. But then they made up and they made more movies.
But you say that Lenny Bruce was not someone you had been a fan of or had awareness of before the film, or you had?
No, I was in New York. I just never saw him. We couldn't have, before I was successful, we couldn't afford to go to nightclubs, right. You know, it was expensive, and I love it, the jazz is what's so extraordinary. I was next to you. Jazz never dates. Jazz is the same now as it was then. It was,
beautiful score.
Oh, and I had time. No, I didn't. I had never seen him. I had never seen. I don't think any comedian. I didn't go to nightclubs much. And I went out to L.A. because someone said to me, if you want to know Lenny Bruce, you got to go see Sally Marr, his mother, who was alive. And I went. She was very friendly. She introduced me to one of his best friends who we used to shoot up with. And he, in turn, introduced me to friends of Lenny. And I had a tape recorder, you know, like a Wallace, not a Wallace, like a Pearl tape recorder. And I taped everything, and she says, you want to go to Vegas? Because they're all there, all his friends, Buddy Hackett, other people. And I said, oh, my God, yes. And I was taking all these notes. It was the best time of research I ever had. They all said the same thing, except Buddy Hackett. They said, you know Broadway, Danny Rose, that thing that Woody Allen did, you know? And they used to get together, the comedians, Lenny and these guys, when they were, you know, certain, whether it was, I don't know, Cantors or, and they said they'd sit around and do what they did in Broadway, you know, tell jokes, and they'd suddenly look around, and Lenny was always very quiet, and suddenly he's gone, because he was a shy guy, apparently, and he's gone, and they look around, they don't know where he is, and then they find him in the kitchen, talking to the people that work in the kitchen, the help. He loved to just talk to the people and ask questions and find out stuff. I think he originally, this is just stuff I had heard, they kind of say it in the movie, the musicians were more important to him than the audience. Because when you do show after show after show, if you notice, the musicians are always sitting like that, you know, because they...
Racing with the moon.
Yes, I know, I saw you do that. Of Vaughn Monroe. and Lenny felt that if he could crack up the musicians, then he was getting somewhere. I think he wanted to be in Hollywood. He wanted to be an actor also, I had heard.
You shot this movie where?
We shot a lot of it in Florida.
The nightclubs, the stage work?
Yeah, one nightclub, basically, I think. The scene when we were sitting next to each other, the scene up there where I'm in my raincoat and...
And you pointed out to me.
Yes. When I came back after my 3 months, I had all this stuff to give Bob. You got to put this in. You got to put that in. You got to put that. And the one thing that he kept was that scene. And the reason he did is when I was memorizing, it was this is before the kind of media, you know, you had cell phones and all this texting. Some guy heard I was doing the movie. And he had been a student somewhere in Chicago. And he sent me, found out my business address in New York, and he sent me a cassette, and I played it. Word for word, it's that scene. And I got pissed off at Bob because when he shot the master from upstairs, right, in the back, and when I saw it, I said, you didn't cut in. He says, no. So that's 8 minutes. You know, of being up there just in one shot.
One shot.
And again, he was right.
It's nice of you to admit that, actually. It's very generous.
I admit a lot of stuff 40 years later.
Now, but do you think in your, I mean, obviously you're someone who, when you, I mean, I don't believe anything I read, but I mean,
I really don't.
Me of all people, I really, I try to minimize that in my life if I can. But for you, obviously, you know, very fastidious and very, very, lots of questions and lots of seeking and so forth in the work you were doing. And what do you think that comes from in terms of all the films you've made from Graduate on into Cowboy and everything like that, where you just seem so, what's the word? I mean, you're so...
Jewish.
Is that it? I'll convert if it's that simple. I'm going to convert tomorrow if that's what's going to get me into your stratosphere. But the thing is, you just seem like you always have something to prove.
Yes.
A lot of people got where you got, and they did what you did, and you scored with these performances and the originality. But then you keep going, and you still feel like you have... Did you feel that way? You still had something to prove again and again and again? What drove you?
I guess the same thing that still drives me. Kobe Bryant was... interviewed recently. It was before he, you know, had to step out for the season because he hurt himself. I saw the interview and I wrote it down. I told my son Jake, it was basketball, same question. You know, all these years of great basketball playing, and he still spends so much time practicing and playing, whatever. Why? And he said, I guess for the challenge of every day. It's a beautiful sentence.
I have only one slight personal connection to Lenny Bruce, and that is that Marvin Worth was a dear friend of
yes.
mine. He died in 1998.
The producer.
He produced this film. He produced Malcolm X with Spike. He produced a lot of great... And he was Bruce's manager. Marvin Worth, who was from Brooklyn, and his wife, Joan, they were from Brooklyn, and he had one of the heaviest New York accents I've ever heard in my life. His voice was down here. He had a very heavy accent like this. And he said to me, I'm going to revive Lenny on Broadway, and I want you to play Lenny. I go, what? And he said, I got 1,000 hours of tapes of Lenny. I got Julian Barry. We got so much material of Lenny's. He said, there's so much stuff we can put in there. Now, don't worry about that. It's all going to work like a charm. And I go, and he goes, and you're Dusty, he called you Dusty. Dusty's not the only one who could play that part, by the way. He's not the only person who could play that part. I'm like, uh-huh, sure. And he goes, and I go, but what about the other thing? He goes, what other thing? I go, what about the other thing? He goes, what other thing? What other thing? What other thing? I go, I'm not Jewish. He said, you're from Long Island, right? I said, yeah. He goes, you're halfway there. The rest of it will take care of itself. Don't worry about it.
He would have been wonderful.
But when you did this film, how involved in your films were you before, then, later, in the casting?
Oh, I have to tell you, I'm glad you asked me. It's another example of Fosse's genius, is that I met Honey Bruce, which came first? He cast Valerie Perrine before he met Honey Bruce. And then he met her, and then I met her, not together. And I couldn't believe Honey Bruce, that Valerie was the reincarnation of Honey Bruce.
Oh.
Literally. I mean, it could have been like mother and daughter. And I said, Bob, you had to have met Honey Bruce before you cast Valerie. He says, no, it was just this intuition. I had nothing to do with any of the casting.
Except all your films, you were that way.
Oh, all of it, except Stanley. He was nice enough to have Stanley in it for my manager. In all my films, I mean, The Graduate, they've been trying for 2 years to cast it, and Catherine Ross and myself were the last two to screen test after 2 years, and I heard that they were sitting in the screen room, not particularly excited about our screen test. And I says, well, either we go with them or we don't do it. And it was that kind of a decision. They've said that in interviews. I think Larry Terman said that, the producer. And Midnight Cowboy, he didn't cast John Voight, he cast someone else, and they wouldn't let him out of his contract. And after that happened, I said, please see my friend John Voight. We weren't close friends, but we had been off Broadway together. And he says, no, John Schlesinger said, he read for it, and he doesn't have that Texas accent. He was from Yonkers. I says, yeah, but he's an actor. He can get it, you know. And John immediately went down to Texas, forgot where, with a tape recorder, and spent whatever time, and came back and read for it, and he got the part. But he was second choice. Kate Jackson was the first choice for Kramer versus Kramer. She was in Charlie's Angels, and they were saying, oh, the film will pay back itself before we start shooting, because they were so popular. And then the studio wouldn't let her out. So I kept telling them about this Meryl Streep I had heard about. and they saw her. So there's been a few I've suggested. I've never demanded or, you know, I don't think that works, actually, yeah. Unless you're directing or producing.
Well, some people they have these approvals of casting, and they utilize that in whatever way. And then there's other people who they just don't get involved. They just let that all take care of itself, and it doesn't really change what they do, you know.
Duvall and Hackman and I knew each other from the early days. They're much older. And we never worked together. And suddenly I'm doing this thing a few years ago. We're shooting in New Orleans, a Runaway Jury, and I have a supporting part, and Gene Hackman has a leading part in it. And the director finds out that we knew each other. We went to the Pasadena Playhouse together until he got kicked out after 3 months for not having any talent. And, oh my God, you guys know each other for all this time? 30 years? Yeah. We got to do a scene. So they wrote a scene. It's one of the last scenes in the movie. It takes place in a public bathroom. It's like an 8-page dialogue scene. And afterwards, it was the last thing they shot in the movie. It's over. And Gene and I say, let's go out and get drunk. And we go to an Italian restaurant in New Orleans, and we're getting drunk. And Hackman says, were you scared? I said, I was so scared, man. I thought, yeah, I'm gonna forget my lines. He said he felt exactly the same way. You know, because you are what you are at the beginning. You don't really change. We were unemployed actors for 10 years. And he said to me, and one of the great things ever said, we were this close to each other. He says, do you feel the same way I do after you finish a movie? And he probably made 120 movies. I said, what? Do you feel like you'll never work again?
Yeah, of course.
Every single time. But that's it.
After 5 decades of consistently winning roles every actor dreams of, Hoffman's fears of joblessness remain charming. His latest film, The Program, about Lance Armstrong, will be released later this year. Listen to other episodes of Here's the Thing in our archives, like my conversation with Dick Cavett, whose career as an iconic talk show host includes a 1968 TV interview with hot young newcomer Dustin Hoffman, fresh off his film The Graduate, the tape of which may or may not exist.
There are several versions of what really happened. I just remember being told one day, Dick, they're going to either reuse the tapes or erase them or dump them.
And I said,
what tapes? The ones to the ABC show. And you can have them if you want to for $60 each. And I thought, well, that's a ludicrous amount of money.
Yeah.
But
take a listen at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Today, recorded live at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood as part of the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival. Dustin Hoffman has been nominated for the Oscar for Best Actor 7 times. He's won the award 2. Actors strive for depth and range in their work. Hoffman makes this appear effortless.
There's obviously roles you played, like Kramer versus Kramer and All the President's Men. And you seem, I don't know what word to use, it seems closer to who you are, your voice and your appearance and your the psychologics of it. You're playing a contemporary character. You're not playing somebody with some disability or what have you. It's not Rain Man or someone who's damaged and broken like Cowboy and so forth like that. But you've done both. There's a theatricality to the roles and a vividness to them. And you're not afraid to do that. Where does that come from? From being in the theater?
Yeah. I mean, where are you from?
I told you. I'm from Long Island.
Oh, you're from
I'm from fucking Long Island. Fuck is wrong with you? Long Island.
First of all, I wish we lived in the same city. How old were you when you started studying act?
22.
And when they sent you out, they send you out for certain kinds of parts?
Yeah.
Young leading men?
Yeah, young guys who cried a lot or whatever. Oh.
I'm the short Jew and still with some acne, and I come to New York in 1958 to study. And they always said leading men, young leading men, juveniles, character juveniles. That's what I was designed as. I couldn't get an agent. And that's just code for Semitic. You know, because in those days, the leading man was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and the ethnic person was a character juvenile or character ingenue. It really was that way. Anyway, so I went out a few times I could, you know, go to open auditions, because if you're not equity, then you can't go to a regular audition. And you can't go to a regular audition until you get your equity card. You can't get an equity card until you get a job, so, you know, catch 22. So the few times that I could go, it was the character juvenile. And by hook or crook, Nichols casts Catherine Ross and I in The Graduate, and I'd been just starting to get somewhere off Broadway, doing, you know, my own style of stuff, a hunchback German gay guy with a limp, you know. First thing that I got mentioned for in the New York Times, and Nichols had heard about it, and I got the
screen. You're not kidding. You played a hunchback.
German homosexual, they called him, with a limp. Ronald Ribman.
What was the production?
Harry, Noon, and Knight, and the other actor was, what's his name? Joel Gray. Sorry, Joel. Yes, that was accurate. So he brings me out to test me, and I didn't want to test. I was doing, for the first time in my life, doing well off Broadway. I won an award, and I thought, oh, I'll have a career. You know, I'll do off-Broadway. And you know this as well as I do. You know, if God has said, look, Alec, you'll never be in the movies, you'll never get leading roles if you're struggling for years, you won't even be on Broadway, I will guarantee you a good part off-Broadway for the rest of your life, you'd sign. You would.
Maybe, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so would Hackman, who moved furniture up and down, you know, six flights, and Duval, who worked midnight to eight in the post office, and I was doing waiter jobs and a little acting, teaching if I could. And it's, you know, it's never changed. All, if there's actors here, you know the pain of that. Here he is now taking me out to L.A. and testing, and can we do anything about his nose, I remember. And I'm in, well, the guy is, he said, you don't, and he couldn't believe it. I mean, he's the hottest director from Neil Simon, Broadway, and also Virginia Woolf, he did. There was no hotter director at that moment in time. He was Spielberg. And he said, what do you mean you don't want to do this part? I said, I read the book of Mr. Nichols. It was on the phone. He's in LA. I'm in New York doing a play. I said, Benjamin Braddock in the book. He's 5'11", blonde hair. I says, it's Redford. I said, you don't want me. And he said, no, he says, I would like to test you. He says, you mean he's not Jewish? I said, right, it's Benjamin Braddock. And he said something I've never forgotten. He says, well, maybe he's Jewish inside. Years later, he's from Berlin. Mike, he came here in the early 30s, and he had his own pain because he didn't have a lot of hair. He had scarlet fever. And he not too long ago, just a few years ago, I read in the paper that he never understood why he cast me, and then he finally did through an analysis or something, and he said, because I was like an alter ego of him. He felt like he was me in, on the periphery, you know, out of it, and he was casting himself, the funny-looking guy. Do you know that that movie was shot? And I went back to New York to collect unemployment. It was a lot, because, you know, it's $50 a week. It's getting the most you could get. And they're cutting the movie. Again, I read this in the newspapers. And Lawrence Turman, I think it was the New York Times, a producer, they're showing it all over the Bel Air circuit, Beverly Hills, Bel Air, Brentwood, on the movie the theaters they have in the homes. And over again, Turman said, before it opened, and over again, people in the industry would come up to Larry and say, what a brilliant film you almost had if you hadn't have miscast the lead. And that was the perception.
You know, it's interesting because, speaking of that casting thing, he and I have had a little, there was a whiff of my appreciation of his career. And you might not remember this, I doubt you remember this, but I go to the old Westwood Marquee Hotel because I get called to go and audition for the movie Hero. Oh. And Stephen Frears is the director, and the phone rings. And this is back when I was making films in the 90s and everything, and I'm lighting one off the other, and I'm going to meet this guy. And I'm like, I'm in my car. I'm like, God, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God. Mates, they're going to go to the Westwood Marquee. And they just lay out the facts. They're like, you know, snap out of it. You're going to go to the Westwood Marquee. You're going to meet Stephen Frears. And you're going to have a meeting with Dustin Hoffman. I'm like, God. I love this guy. I want to make this movie with this guy. And all of a sudden, like 20 minutes goes by. And Stephen Frears, now if you know the movie Hero, where someone commits this act, and there's a case of mistaken identity, and Andy Garcia played the other role. So there has to be this case of mistaken identity between the two actors. Stephen Frears, literally 20 minutes in, I mean, my dream is just taking flight. My wings, I'm flying over the Westwood Marquee Hotel. I'm going to make my first movie with Dustin Effin' Hoffman. And Stephen Frears looks at me and goes, you know, I just realized that you don't look anything like Dustin at all. And it was like, there I'm flying, all of a sudden, he shoots my balloon, and I crash onto Westwood Boulevard, and I'm dead on the highway there. I'll never forget. You talk about, yeah, our dreams, how they escape us.
It's but, now called the M, right?
Right.
Yeah, in Westwood.
But the, exactly. When you show up and you work with Schlesinger and you do Cowboy, do you come up with all that and you show him? Did he help you? Did you?
Cowboy, very briefly, he didn't want, it's very similar to Frears and you. He did not want to see me because he had seen The Graduate. And that's the only thing he'd ever seen me in. And he was an artist. He didn't give a shit that I was in a big hit and suddenly an instant star. He wanted the right person, and he refused to see me. And I heard about this. And I had read the book. I thought the script was okay. It was Waldo Salt. He actually came in a room with John Voight and I when we did it, and he had a Wallensack tape recorder. We improvised everything. Everything. The Schlesinger was great at that. And he would go home, Waldo Salt, and write the improvisations into the scenes that he'd already written. Anyway, he wouldn't see me, and I said, please, I got to see him. He's got to see me. And he agreed. I know we're running out of time, so go quick. 42nd Street. What are they called, those things where you go and you put the quarter in? I can't remember.
The Automat.
The Automat. Thank you. And I says,
The Automat.
I'm going to direct a movie of him playing a car.
You all heard it. Go ahead.
And I used to go there, and we all did, you know, 2-3 in the morning, whatever, get coffee, whatever. And it was all kind of trance people there. And I said, I'll meet him in the Automat, and I want to do it about 1 or 2 in the morning because, you know, and I'll dress accordingly, which is what I did, a kind of coat like I wore in that scene, that raincoat. And I didn't shave for a few days, and I greased my hair. I was auditioning, and I came in, and I just met him there, sat there, and he looked at me, and he looked at, you know, sparsely crowded, you know, people around. He says, Oh, he says, yes, I think you'll do quite well.
So the voice and all of it, you just throw that out there. You come up with that.
Oh, well, yeah, you keep trying.
You got to meet my friend O'Daniel, my friend O'Daniel.
You're too kind.
Where do you find this?
You get desperate. But I didn't.
That's my problem. I wasn't desperate enough.
No. And we're rehearsing, and then Schlesinger has to shoot some exteriors before we start shooting principal photography, because he's got winter and he needed winter. So John Voight and I go, and he says, well, you don't have to talk. I says, I don't have a character. I don't have a voice. I said, I can't. I barely have a walk. No, we'll have the camera across the street. You guys just got to walk. We're not starting for a month, but we just need the weather, you know, the smoke coming out, whatever. Okay, so John Voight and I were walking, and John Voight and I knew each other for years. I was the assistant director, which is like, you know, sharpening pencils in Off-Broadway when he was in View from the Bridge with Bob Duvall. He was brilliant. And he was an up-and-coming star. And you know, we were competitive. Actors are always competitive. And, you know, if you're walking down the street, you got a script, you have a reading, or you did the reading, you see another actor coming over, you've always put it behind your back, you know. So, but no, it's just something, you know, because you don't want the competition. Anyway, so we're across the street walking, and so says, all you have to do is walk. I says, yeah, but I'm supposed to cough. We're at that point in the movie where, you know, he's got, you're going to find out he has TB or whatever. He says, yes. Schlesinger says, all right, you'll do some coughing, do some not coughing, but you don't have to talk. I said, okay, I'm rehearsing out of panic, you know, trying on these limps or whatever. And I said, shouldn't be shooting. We got a month to go. I haven't found them yet. And suddenly we're walking and we pause and I'm trying to cough and I threw up. Literally on John Voight's cowboy boots. And afterwards, Schlesinger says, I think we've got it. You did. And John, because he's an actor and, you know, we're competitive, Schlesinger told me later, he went up to Schlesinger and he said, John, let me just ask you something. Is he going to do that all throughout the movie? He says, because I'm not even in the scene if he does. You know?
Well, let me just say this, because obviously, I mean, I got another 45 questions I could ask, but they do have a schedule here for the festival. But I do want to say, I mean, as sappy as this sounds, on behalf of everybody here, I want to say thank you to you, because I really, from the bottom of my heart, you are one of the greatest movie actors that has ever lived in the history of this country. You are one of the greatest movie actors ever. And you know so many great folks. Please help me in thanking Dustin Hoffman, everyone.
Dustin Hoffman has gained some hard-won wisdom during his career. And despite turning 78 this summer, he's embracing a very new way to share it. He's teaching an acting class online. The description reads, Dustin teaches you everything he wishes someone had taught him. You can sign up at masterclass.com. This is Alec Baldwin. Thanks this week to Sean Cameron and everyone at Turner Classic Movies. You're listening to Here's the Thing.
I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes.
Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio in association with Stony Brook Southampton Graduate Arts.